Hello, and welcome to the November 22nd, 2022 episode of the Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. This is Craig W. Hurst, Emeritus Professor of Music, podcasting from my music bunker, along with my faithful canine companion, Carmel the Wonder Dog, to share with you my latest musical interests and discoveries. I claim no special inside information about the latest or greatest music, nor do I know everything there is to know about music. What I am is a lover of music. I enjoy several genres of music, and I share with you what has currently caught my interest, old, new, outdated, and everything in between. Even old music is brand new if you have never heard it before. The universe of music is a vast one to enjoy. From my discussions, you might find something new to you and of interest to expand your own musical universe. I currently receive no compensation or motivation of any kind from any recording label, recording artist, or estate of any performer or composer dead and gone to discuss their music and or recordings. Now with that out of the way, welcome to my musical universe. My guest today is blues guitarist and singer Nick Moss of the band The Nick Moss Band featuring Dennis Grunling. Blues guitar virtuoso Nick Moss and harmonica wizard Dennis Grunling have been on a winning streak since they first joined forces in 2016. With relentless, non-stop touring and the release of their Alligator Records debut, The High Cost of Low Living, in 2018, the Nick Moss Band featuring Dennis Grunling has been playing for wildly enthusiastic fans and winning over critics and radio programmers worldwide. Debuting at number 3 on the Billboard Blues charts, the album topped many 2018 Best Of lists. UK Tastemaker magazine Mojo said, "Guitarist and singer Nick Moss shows the world his fearsome guitar chops and his complete familiarity with the great tradition of Chicago blues music. Partnered with harmonica player Dennis Grunling, Moss creates a two-headed monster that takes the band thundering through crisp originals." Their self-made lucky streak continued into early 2019 when down-and-dirty guitarist Moss, a 30-year veteran of Chicago's take-no-prisoners rough-and-tumble West and South Side blues clubs, won the Blues Music Award, BMA, for Traditional Blues Male Artist of the Year. Grunling, one of the hottest players on the scene today, took the BMA for Best Instrumentalist Harmonica. And now, with the odds heavily in their favor, they unleashed their dynamic Lucky Guy in 2019. Lucky Guy, produced by Kid Anderson, guitarist for Rick Estrin and the Nightcats, and Moss, and recorded at Anderson's Greaseland studio in San Jose, California, is a foot-stomping showcase featuring the classic Chicago blues sound the band is known for. But, as Moss himself notes, there are also a few other flavors, including Louisiana swamp pop, West Coast blues, New Orleans funk, and even some proto-rock and roll. All but one of the 14 songs are originals, with 11 by Moss and 2 by Grunling. The band delivers each one with uncompromising skill and authority. Start to finish, Lucky Guy is a joyous sonic blast of pure blues power. Guitar hero Nick Moss paid his dues gigging in the city's blues clubs under the tutelage of some of the city's greatest blues luminaries. His fiery fretwork, gruff, soul-charged vocals, and memorable original songs place him in a league of his own. New Jersey's Dennis Grunling is considered among today's best blues harmonica players. His high energy, full throttle playing has earned him comparisons to the late James Cotton. Living blues, says Nick Moss's muscular, electric energy, combines jaw-dropping guitar, gruff, soulful vocals, and impassioned songwriting. Grunling is a contemporary harmonica master, impressive, genuine, and fresh sounding. Growing up in Chicago and standing tall at 6'2", Moss dreamed of playing both music and sports. His mother was a huge blues fan, even taking a young Nick to see Muddy Waters live in concert. Kidney surgery sidelined his athletic hopes. To lift his spirits, Nick's brother snuck the 18-year-old Nick out of the hospital soon after his surgery and took him across the street to see alligator artists Little Charlie and the Nightcats perform. It was there and then that Nick dove headfirst into the blues, deciding that a career as a blues man was for him. Originally a bass player, Moss got his first professional break touring and playing with legendary West Side Chicago guitarist Jimmy Fast Fingers Dawkins. He next toured with Willie Big Eyes Smith, leader of the legendary blues band. Finding himself in need of a guitarist, Smith insisted Moss switch instruments. Combining his natural talent with nonstop woodshedding and playing every jam session, Moss quickly became one of the city's most highly sought-after players. Bluesman Jimmy Rogers hired Moss to join his touring band and became his mentor. Moss's other influences include B.B. King, Freddie King, Earl Hooker, Magic Slim, and other groundbreaking players. Moss formed his own band in 1997 and released the first of his 13 albums a year later on his own independent Blue Bella label. Since then, he's earned legions of fans around the world, playing over 100 shows a year. Moss has shared stages with Buddy Guy, Kenny Wayne Shepherd, Gary Clark Jr., David Hidalgo, and many others, and is an in-demand guest, always welcome to sit in with his musician friends around the world. The Nick Moss Band featuring Dennis Grunling will prove it's not luck but talent that earns them standing ovations night after night as they barnstorm clubs, concert halls, roadhouses, and festival stages. "When the band and I get on stage," says Moss, "the music takes over. We can't hold back, and the energy just comes pouring out. We get carried away, and the audience gets carried away with us. And once that happens, everyone is in luck. It is my pleasure to welcome to my musical universe, Nick Moss." Hello, Nick.
Hey, how are you, sir?
I'm doing very well, thank you. It's really great to talk with you and to have you as a guest on my podcast. Really happy to have you here. You know, many, if not most of my listeners will know that Chicago is home of the electric style called Chicago blues. And I think it's safe to say that many listeners are going to be familiar with certain icons associated with Chicago blues, such as Chess Records and Alligator Records and people like Muddy Waters and Little Walter and Buddy Guy and others. What many of us may not be familiar with is the more recent blues scene in Chicago. So could you kind of bring us up to speed? With is blues still alive and well in Chicago, and what's the scene like?
You know, very much so. It's still very relevant. You know, one of the most iconic clubs in Chicago is still Buddy Guy's Clubs. Buddy's been, I mean, he's had his club for what, 30 years now, I think now, maybe longer. And there's clubs like Kingston Mines that have been around for maybe 50 years. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you have a place like Fitzgerald's, which is, you know, just outside of the Chicago border in Berwyn, Illinois, you know, responsible for bringing in, you know, some of the best blues, not only in Chicago, but nationally. And in fact, they recently sold to another owner who kept the tradition going. Has not changed much other than the aesthetics of the club. He's updated some things and made a nice, you know, venue even nicer. And actually, you know, included in the last 2 years, a new blues festival that he does every September. Hmm. And very widely attended, had, you know, wonderful acts. So in Chicago, you know, on any given day of the week, you can go find, you know, blues, not only in the local blues clubs, but in a lot of just, you know, nightclubs, bars, little speakeasies, little watering holes, all over the city. You know, it's still relevant, sure.
Oh, that's good to know. It's still very much a part of the DNA of the city's culture and very much a part of that. You know, I live near Milwaukee, and Milwaukee's always kind of in the shadow of Chicago. And, you know, we have probably not nearly as big a scene musically as Chicago does, but we certainly have, you know, some going on. And yeah. Milwaukee's a very musical town in many ways as well. But
great blues icons themselves, you know. I mean, just off the top of my head, I mean, two of the guys that I spent a good deal of my life playing with on the road with legendary blues band and Jimmy Rogers. And in fact, my own band was Madison Slim and Piano Willie O'Shaughnessy right out of Milwaukee. And yeah. And I've spent many years going up there playing with Jim Lyban and Kurt Koenig. And I remember seeing Stokes and Milwaukee Slim and all those guys. Yeah. So your city definitely has plenty to be proud of in blues.
Yeah. Yeah. We've even kind of expanded out here more into the suburbs where I am. I'm actually about 25 miles out of downtown, but we have a nice little blues festival out here in August, and in Heartland, Wisconsin, which is not far from Waukesha, and had some good people in for that in the past, and have enjoyed hearing it live. Well, when we talk about blues as a music, is the blues now an international style, or is it still kind of a regional style that is imitated internationally? Now, what I'm thinking about here to kind of add some fuel to the fire of your answer is I'm thinking about all the various pockets of blues styles within the United States.
Right.
And then also all of the English blues and blues influenced English rock bands, you know, the Thames River cotton fields, if you will.
Right.
So
go ahead.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, so your view of blues as a musical style and how it kind of exists in the big picture of world culture.
That is a multi-layered question with a multi-layered answer. That's so many different ways. So the way I see it is this is blues music has so many different flavors. It's they have more flavors than Baskin Robbins. Okay. So I think, to me, whatever your discerning tastes are towards music or towards blues music is what you should always lean towards. However, I like to taste everything. You know, I want to know what something else tastes. So I feel like the people that you know, aren't afraid to, you know, experience something different might be surprised. And so you have a lot of different, I'm going to start with fans and listening people first before I delve into like musicians, but there's a lot of people that grew up on blues through the bands like you were talking about. Let's just put it this way. There's not too many people left around that grew up listening to straight traditional blues. There just isn't, you know, because it's been around for so long. But most of the people that are still around today enjoying the blues shows and going to festivals were introduced to it through like these great, the, as you said, what at the Thames River cotton fields.
Yeah.
But, you know, those English bands really reinvigorated blues, and they really made Americans realize that they had something special here. And it's kind of unfortunate that it took someone from over the pond to make people here realize. Unfortunately, it wasn't a very large amount of people that they made realize that, you know, it's still a small community of blues fans around the world, you know, comparatively speaking to pop music, country music, and even jazz. So I feel like I'm more of a traditionalist. However, I've delved into more rock blues and more jam band oriented blues in my career. I've put out records just because, you know, I went through a phase where like, I'm one of those guys. I was introduced to blues because of my mom's record collection, and because I have an older brother, Joe Moss, who's a wonderful guitar player and musician himself. And we listened to these rock bands, the Rolling Stones, you know, first the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Robin Trower. My uncle would buy us records by Blind Faith, and, you know, and then ZZ Top, and then Stevie Ray Vaughan came around. And then like, so we were kind of introduced to it through the rock side first, but at a very early age, because of my enthusiasm for the music, I wanted to know more about it. And that's that, like that wormhole you get into. The more you learn about something, the more excited you become, like you dived into this hole. And so I started learning about the older guys,
mm-hmm.
going backwards and trying to find records by these guys. And then the more I heard their music, and it just seemed to reach me. Some people say, oh, it was more authentic. I don't know. I can't say what's more authentic to someone else. I can only, from my experience, and I'm not going to say it was more authentic. It just hit me at a deeper level. You know, I'm very grateful for the bands that led me there.
Uh-huh.
But I remember even as a small child, not understanding a lot about the world, but I remember my mother buying the record Indianola Mississippi Seeds by B.B. King. Now, I was a kid. I don't know what that's about. I didn't even know what a B.B. King was, you know, or who he was. So to me, I thought a B.B. King was like, I had no idea what it was. But my mom played this record, and I just remember even as a little kid stopping dead in my tracks. And like before I even heard the music, I felt it. It was like this electric buzz. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's things like that have always driven me to find more music and find why I'm feeling that way, why I'm enjoying it that much. So I've always dug deeper. And so, yeah, you know, when you do that, I can't deny anybody for their choice of music. If that's how it hits you and that's how it reaches you, you know, all I can say is bless you, man, because, you know, without that type of feeling in this world, this would be a really boring place. So if you like traditional blues, if you like rock blues, if you like country blues, if you like, you know, soul blues, that stuff doesn't bother me. However, what does bother me is I was gonna say I'm not sure if it bothers me, but I know it does. It bothers me, but it also baffles me what an importance we put on not only labels, but, you know, I look at the jazz world in particular, and I see what an importance we put on the jazz culture, and how in the jazz culture, how much of an importance they put on traditional jazz, you know, and how much reverence that that's given. And, you know, jazz moves forward. Jazz has always moved forward, and they've allowed it to move forward, but there is still a very great deal of respect and reverence given towards traditional jazz and the guys that still play traditional jazz and play it well. And it just doesn't seem like it's the same in the blues world. You know, I always hear this narrative, oh, it's got to move forward. It's got to move forward. I have no problem with it moving forward. I have no problem with bands and musicians that do take blues into another realm or into a new territory. You know, that's their prerogative. I just fear that the traditional side of blues is still getting pushed back further and further and further and further and further.
You know, Nick, I'm nodding my head a lot because everything you're saying is resonating with me 100%. You know, I remember back, as a young, in the 60s when I was growing up, never knowing the Rolling Stones had such a deep blues background, because they were never marketed to us as a blues band, or right. The Animals, or my right. goodness, even Eric Clapton, who we know, you know, or you could even go as far as like Led Zeppelin, which really was a blues band on steroids. I mean, that's the right. way I like to.
Mr. Robert Plant's lyrics were lifted.
yeah. But you know, the one that really slapped me up the side of the head was I used to love the Allman Brothers Statesboro Blues. And right. it wasn't until I found out that was not their song, that it was a cover. And I started digging in to find out who the original artist was. And then when you hear the original, you just kind of go, oh my gosh, where's this guy been all of my life?
Right.
Because that music speaks to you in such a great way. And I hear what you're saying about embracing the roots of blues music, or the forefathers, the foremothers, however you want to call it, because that sets the table for so much American popular music, but especially blues and jazz music. And I think that, you know, you hit, I think, the nail right on the head, which comes in my wheelhouse because I'm an educator. And I used to have so much fun when I taught history of rock and roll. Mm-hmm. And I would talk about a particular song and I'd say, yeah, but here's the original, guys. This is, you know, I would play like Aerosmith doing my Big 10 Inch, right?
Right.
And I'd say, well, but here's the original by Bull Moose Jackson. And this was recorded before your parents were born, you know, kind of thing. And they're like, oh, wow, you know, their eyes get big and all that kind of stuff. And to really try to inject them with that curiosity to find out where, you know, this stuff comes from. And the whole thing of the fascination with Eric Clapton and Stevie Ray Vaughan and so forth. You know, and then going back to his big influence, Robert Johnson. Well, Robert Johnson's album, King of the Blues, is what really, you know, influenced so many English rock artists. But I hear you. I think audiences, my take on it is what I see in a lot of blues audiences I go are people who are old rock and rollers who have want to listen to more of the original style instead of like modern rock music, which is pulled further and further away from the blues.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm with you on all that stuff. I believe I have a lot of friends that play more of the rock blues than traditional blues.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like I said, I can't deny someone for what pulls them in whatever direction that they're going. And I appreciate what they're doing, you know, artistically and stylistically, I appreciate what they're doing. I just feel like for me, the only thing that really makes me feel fulfilled when I play is playing the older style of blues, the way it was meant to play. I would never even dare to say that I'm playing it the way that the masters who created it played it.
Sure.
All I can do is say that I'm trying to show my respect and show my reverence and show that I've really put my, I mean, I'm 52 now, and I've spent more than 2/3 of my life devoted to playing this music and playing it the right way and learning about it and learning about the culture and learning about the people. Basically, you know, I live it, breathe it, eat it, sleep it, walk it, talk it. And that's me. That's just what I do. You know, my whole thing is like, I just wish, like I said, that there were more people in the blues world, more people in the blues community, just starting there, more people in the blues world and blues community gave it the reverence and respect that the jazz community gives their forefathers and the members and musicians that still play a traditional form of music, and the way they keep it relevant and keep it like it's held in very high regard in the jazz world. Most of the jazz guys I know that play in and around the world, and especially in Chicago, the guys that I know, you know, there's a sense of what's the word I'm looking for?
A sense of reverence.
Yeah, sense of reverence, but
reverence and respect.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Keeping that part alive, and it just doesn't seem to be as much in the blues world. And then, you know, just, you know, you were talking about like a world culture stage. Like when I go to Europe, when I play in Europe, it's only been in the last maybe 10, 15 years that I've noticed that there's been a more uptick. There's been more uptick or more importance placed on rock blues. For the first like 20 years that I was going to Europe as a teenager, as an early 20s, you know, going with guys like Jimmy Rogers and Willie Smith and stuff, traditional blues was the thing that they wanted to see. The bands that were forming in and around Europe, when we go to England, Norway, France, Germany, even Spain, you'd see all these bands popping up in those countries, and they wanted to play traditional blues.
They were
playing traditional blues. And now you start seeing there's still a lot of great traditional blues bands even in Europe, and you know, you had mentioned earlier that they are kind of I'm not going to say copying. To me, I feel like they're just doing the same thing, showing respect and reverence in their way, singing it with their accents, but they're playing it the right way and stuff. But you see a lot of more of the rock stuff happening. But I still think that the traditional stuff is still held in a higher regard in Europe than it is here. And that's another thing that kind of, you know, bothers me. This is an American art form. At first and foremost, it's an African American art form created by, you know, people that were, you know, were held in captivity, and they had nothing else to do to entertain themselves, to sing songs and come up with music, and they came up with it. African American culture came up with this music. Some people can claim, you know, some people claim that it's a hybrid of African cultures and some, you know, folk music from what, like I've heard that it's Celtic and Anglo folk music mixed with, but more so it's African beats, and even like the banjo was created in Africa and stuff. But this is a truly American art form that we've given to, like, one of the few American art forms that we can actually claim,
mm-hmm.
you know, that American claim that African Americans gave us, that we can give to the world, and we don't even show it the respect it's deserved.
You know, it's part of that old saying, the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. So we keep our eye on the other side of the fence instead of what's right in our own backyard.
Yeah.
And I think, that when you talked about the English rock bands really being behind a revival of interest in the blues in the United States, it was because, like I say, they were showing us, hey, look, you've got this right here. You ought to be, you know, paying attention and just, you know, really, really enjoying it. And I think that we do. I like to hear bands that do, you know, traditional tunes, but, you know, do it in your own way. And there's nothing wrong with that. You're still paying homage to the people who came before you. And nobody, I mean, I certainly don't think anyone ever would accuse you of being a cover band or a cover artist.
No, I mean, I definitely play my fair share of classic cover tunes by the greats and stuff. I mean, I spent quite a few years with Jimmy Rogers, and he's still one of my biggest influences. And so, mm-hmm. like, you know, you're going to hear me play some Jimmy Rogers tunes,
sure. in my head,
because I mean, that's the guy that taught me. And when I play them, that's the first thing you'll hear me say. This is by, you know, the late, great Jimmy Rogers, who I get to spend time with and who taught me a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll play some Muddy Waters, some Howlin' Wolf here and there, but like most of the stuff, I'm currently working on, I believe, my 15th CD now. So it'll be, my 15th CD. I don't even know. I believe it's my 15th CD. And 99% of the songs that I've written over the years have been my own songs. I usually like to include at least one cover on one of my CDs. However, this record, there's 14 songs that I just recorded. Not one of them is a cover.
Yeah.
Now, are they reminiscent of other songs? Yeah. Are they in the style of other classics? They sure are, because that's the way I learn. That's the music I love, and that's who I'm trying to show respect and pay respect to keep the music alive, to keep the blues tradition alive in my way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think you bring up an excellent point. I mean, who you listen to and who you study with then becomes really part of your own musical DNA. And you can't deny that you're going to be influenced by those experiences. But nonetheless, you've recombined it all in a unique way that makes you unique. And the way that you do it is uniquely different. So I think, you know, it's like if, you know, you were to do a Muddy Waters song, you're not going to sound like Muddy Waters, because you're not Muddy Waters.
Nobody can sound like that.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Well, Nick, I'm curious to know, you kind of alluded that you've been in the studio, and yep. have you been doing this most recent recording with your regular band, or have you been using other side musicians?
No, it's my regular band.
Great. Well, tell us about these musicians in your band.
Absolutely. So we're all kind of spread out. My rhythm section, I'm very fortunate, lives here in Chicago. So, I'll start with those guys. So before COVID happened in, 2017, was going through some changes in the band, trying out different bass players. And there was a bass player that I had been friendly with for quite a few years that lived in Brazil, who played with a great band in Brazil. I don't know, some of your listeners might be aware of the Igor Prado band. I mean, you talk about bands from other countries, this one of the killer bands. playing the music the right way, traditionally played, and just really well put together band. And huge fan of theirs. Yeah. But the bass player in that band, his name was Rodrigo Mantovani. We kind of hit it off right off the bat. You know, one of those guys, just like, I like-minded, just a sweetheart of a guy. And, you know, would come to visit the U.S. every now and then. We had a great friend in common who passed away a few years back, named Linwood Slim. Maybe some of your listeners will know who Linwood Slim was, great harmonica player, singer out of L.A. And, you know, he'd come to visit Slim in L.A. and then fly to Chicago and stay with me for a couple of days. Well, it just so happens that he was ending his tenure with his band in Brazil. And I didn't even know it at the time, but I was going through bass players and I jokingly sent him a message on Facebook of all places. Hey man, you want to come to Chicago and be my bass player? And like 2 seconds later, I got a private message like, when do you need me? And I was like, are you kidding me? And he's like, no, man, I'm looking to get out of here. I want to get out of Brazil. I want to, you know, come to Chicago where the music started. I'd love to play if you're serious. And I was like, I'm serious as a heart attack. And that week we got on the ball and tried to look for how to get a visa. And he, within months, he was here. And by 2018, he had flown in to do some gigs with us to make sure it was a right fit. And pretty much moved here the end of 2018, I believe. And then 2019, we recorded the Lucky Guy CD that he's on. Mm-hmm. On Alligator Records. And so he basically lived with me all through COVID, him and his wife. And, you know, recently, last year, they moved into the city, into Chicago city proper, and got themselves their own place now. And he's been with me for now, you know, 2018 till up till now. And
5 years.
Yeah. And he's by not just my standards, but by many in the business, guys all around the country, and in fact around the world, would tell you that he's probably one of the best. I'm going to just say he's one of the greatest practitioners of traditional blues bass on upright and electric. Mm-hmm. And his knowledge is unparalleled. Mm-hmm. Like going back to the 1920s.
Wow.
Of music, his record collection, like even just living here in 5 years, the record collection he's built, because he had to get rid of his record collection in Brazil. He's like, he's insane with the music in a good way. Mm-hmm. You know? And so I'm very fortunate to have him. He's like my musical partner. He's also just, like I said, he's turned out to be one of my best friends. And in fact, probably one of my brothers, I would call him for sure. My longtime drummer of 13 years, Patrick Seals, he moved on during COVID, and we recently just employed a new young drummer, young kid, who I've known his father for quite a few years. So he already had a musical background, and this kid's just turned 21, and you'd think he's been playing for 30 years. Mm-hmm. The kid, his feel and his respect for traditional blues as a drummer. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I talked to him like a year ago when he was 20 and I was asking him like, you know, what are you listening to? And he's like, oh, I like, you know, S.P. Leary, Willie Big Eyes Smith, Sam Lay, Odie Payne. He's like naming off these drummers, like no 20-year-old kid should know that, mm-hmm. You know? So his name is Pierce Downer. Mm-hmm. And these guys, you know, we're the ones here in Chicago kind of holding down the fort. And then, you know, my musical collaborator and partner for the last, since 2016, is Dennis Grunling. And he's mm-hmm. probably, again, arguably one of the greatest harmonica players on the planet. But he lives in Los Angeles. So trying to get this record made, you know, through COVID and a lot of planning and a lot of plans falling through until eventually we could all get together. So he came out here, and my piano player, who I used for many years, who Not sure what's going on there, if he's going to be able to tour with us, because again, COVID changed a lot of things for people. Mm-hmm. But he came up here and recorded with us on the CD Taylor Strife. And Taylor was another young kid years ago that I kind of picked up out of nowhere and just was like, yeah, I want to play traditional blues piano. I want to dove into it head first and started learning all the masters and trying to play Big Maceo and Pine Top and Sunnyland Slim and, you know, you name it. And he was trying to figure it out and dissect it and play it. And he ended up, to me, becoming, you know, one of the finer young blues piano players around, which there aren't very many. Yeah. That's probably one of the most endangered species of the blues world is the piano player. Mm-hmm. Well, these guys all came in to record. And then I was really fortunate to have a couple friends put some parts on. A local guy in Chicago who is vastly under-recorded under his own name, but has recorded and played with some of the greatest names in Chicago blues, including Buddy Guy and Otis Rush. And he has his own band, his brother John Katke. And John's like a multi-instrumentalist. He's like a genius guitar player, killer, plays all the brass and reed instruments, and an amazing keyboard player. And he played some organ on a tune, some B3 organ on a tune for me. And then, again, my favorite saxophone player on the planet is a guy out of Boston, Gordon Beadle, better known as Sax Gordon. And he's one of the few guys left on the planet still playing like the old school. Like, he's one of the true honkers, and knows like the old style of blues, guys like JT Brown and I'm losing my train of thought. I'm sorry. But anyways, these guys came in and added some parts too. So I'm really excited. That's all right now. I'm just finishing up the mixing stages. You know, we've been, everything's recorded and mixing, and it's gone to the record company Alligator and doing some minor tweaks. And hopefully my hope is that it'll be out sometime in the spring.
Well, we'll be looking. Can you reveal a title for us, or is that something you'd have to tell me and then kill me?
No, you know what? I haven't really chose. I've got two or three songs on the record that I'm really partial to. And you know, it's fluctuating, and I haven't really put my finger yet on the title.
To be named later.
Yeah, to be named later.
Okay. All right. Well, that's fine. We can always find it under your name. And that sounds really, you know, great. And you talk, you know, like COVID, oh my gosh, did that just mix a lot of things up for everybody in a lot, you know, in many different ways. But what I'd like to kind of shift gears to, you mentioned Alligator Records, and which is, my goodness, it's hard to believe Alligator Records has been around, 50 years now, almost 50 years.
No, they just had their 50th anniversary.
That's right. That's right. And of course, Alligator kind of, in many ways, kind of replaced Chess as that venerable Chicago label. But can you talk a little bit about the label, about Alligator Records as a producer of blues recordings and promoters of the blues? I mean, I get their newsletters, I'm on their mailing list, you know, and I see that aspect of it, but I'd like to hear from the perspective of a musician who records for them, you know, the support and the kind of the environment that they provide for you.
It's invaluable and amazing to have someone, you know, is invested in this music as Bruce Iglauer is, and the whole staff is at Alligator Records. I was unaware of a lot of things prior to being with Alligator. You know, I spent a good deal of my early development as a musician trying to get the attention of a record label like Alligator or Blind Pig or Blacktop Records back in my day. Those were the big three. Mm-hmm. And the only one left standing is Alligator. So that ought to tell you something right now. But you know, I was relegated to putting my own CDs out, and I'm very happy and fortunate that I was able to do that with to some degree of success for many years. But when the opportunity came to record for Alligator, you know, it's something that I had as a, even as a kid, had kind of dreamt about. You know, I remember my parents buying Alligator Blues Deluxe, which was recordings from the old Chicago Fest. And, you know, Barroom Preacher, Jimmy Johnson, you know, as records, when my parents saw, you know, could see that my brother and I were getting into blues music and stuff. And I remember the first time my brother went, you know, I had an ailment as a teenager, a kidney ailment. And my brother, to cheer me up, took me to go see some band, snuck me into a bar to go see some band that he heard on WXRT radio. Said, oh man, this band sounds great. We got to go see him. So, you know, I'm in full bandages, you know, basically have tubes coming out of me. And my brother dressed me up to hide all my ailments and snuck me in a blues club. And we saw Little Charlie and the Nightcats on their first tour, basically under their first album on Alligator Records. And just changed my whole world, kind of, you know. At that point, I thought I was going to go to college and play college football, but due to my ailments, I was told I could never play contact sports again. And I remember seeing these guys in this club one night, and I was like, that's what I want to do. I mean, I was already kind of playing music as a hobby, and I knew how much music meant to me when I would listen to it, but watching these guys play and hearing the style of music that they played and how well they played it, and how enthusiastic they were about it. You know, my life changed that night. And these guys were on Alligator Records. I remember buying their cassette that night. That's how long ago that was, a cassette. And, you know, just seeing Bruce Iglauer's name and Alligator Records on there. And I was like, oh, you know, one day maybe I'll get to record for Alligator. So when that day came, it was a pretty surreal moment. And I'll tell you a quick story. I remember, so like I said, I had put out most of my own recordings up to 2016, from 2000 to 2016. I put out all my own recordings with the help of my lovely wife, Kate Moss, who's a great graphic designer, did all my cover art, who also used to do a lot of cover art for Delmark Records. Her better business sense on how to run things and her enthusiasm for also doing research on how to do things, you know, so she really was the head of the company. But we did it, and we put it out blindly, and so for whatever reason, we started getting noticed as a legitimate label. Mm-hmm. And would put out not only my records, but some friends of ours records. And, you know, and we were doing it all through like trial and error. And I remember when Bruce took me up in early 2017, I believe, way after he had already made the decision to take the release that I had recorded, which ended up becoming High Cost of Low Living, which was my first Alligator CD. When he decided to take that on, he said, well, you know, one of the things I like to do is I like to take the artists to meet the staff and, you know, get a sense of the staff. And I was like, okay. So I remember going down to Alligator, the office, and I was thinking I was going to meet like three or four people, and, you know, and we go upstairs into this tiny little like kitchen area, and there's a table, and there's like 12 people sitting there. And I was like, who are all these people? I didn't even know that the staff was that big. Mm-hmm. And for the next 3 hours, I sat there while each person went around the room, explaining who they were and what their job duties was and what they would be doing to help me and Alligator promote this record.
Wow.
And the whole time I was sitting there, all I could think in my brain was like, wow, this is what goes on in a record label? I'm like, man, have I been doing it wrong all this time? I was like, how did we even get as far as we got, not knowing all you know, sure, all the things that we should have been doing? So it was really an eye opener. And just knowing that you have a support system and a staff like that is like invaluable. And Bruce, another guy that, not an easy guy to get to know, not an unfriendly guy. I like, through the years I'd known him and was friendly enough with him, but not a very easy guy to know until you actually do know him. And the one thing that I found out is his love of the music, his love of the men and women who created this music is like he'll tell a story and his eyes well up.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about Coco Taylor and Hound Dog and even guys that he didn't record that he was around seeing before he even started the label that made him want to start a label like Alligator. Like, mm-hmm, seeing his eyes well up is like touching as hell. Like I get choked up thinking about it just now. You know, especially being my age and being around and the guys that I got to play with, and now they're not around anymore. And when, as I get older and I think about that, it means so much more to me now, you know. And I could sit and listen to Bruce tell his stories for hours. And so, and there have been times when I have, when, yeah, we've so, yeah, off that we came to talk about one thing and 2 hours later it's about these stories, and I'm just sitting there like, yeah, okay, and then what happened? You know, it's
sure.
So for me as a true student of this music, I would never call myself a historian, but as a true student of this music, who still I believe is a student and learning, I love every, mm-hmm, bit of it. I love as much as I can get to knowledge and understanding in the stories. Is it just means the world to me. And so, yeah, being with Alligator, I'm extremely happy.
You know, it's I've had the opportunity to talk to just a couple of different people who are affiliated with record labels, and you know, you really get a sense of people who are in the music business because it's a business, versus those who are in the music business because they love music.
Right.
If you know what I mean. I mean, obviously it's a business, but there's people who are passionate about business, and there are people who are passionate about music and the art. And so much so that it, you know, they do it as much for love as they do for money.
Absolutely.
You know?
And I'm, you know, to that point, I want to also say, like, Bruce, I've heard him on more than one occasion in our conversations, you know, to be quite honest, Bruce is getting up in years, you know, he's still in great shape. I mean, for his age, I'm always like amazed, like how spry he is and stuff. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that he always says is, like, it's not, obviously the music and is super important to him, and keeping this music alive is super important to him too. But one of the things that I really find endearing also is the fact that, like, I asked him, like, what drives you to keep doing this at your age? And he said, because I want to make sure that there's something left for my staff when I'm not here.
Mm.
Keep this going.
Mm-hmm.
Not only for my family, but for my staff, the people that have been invested all these years working with me. I want to make sure that there's something there for them. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, man, that makes me,
yeah,
really have more respect and for him and what he does.
That's a very different kind of level of commitment when you're, yeah, that committed to people who work with you. And I kind of get the impression from your talking about the staff that they're probably about as committed to, they're as committed to the music as Bruce is and as you are. Sounds to me like that whole staff is, you know, very, very much nuts about music.
Yeah, they're all in their own way. I mean, sure. They all have varying tastes, but their commitment to the music and the record label is like, you know, mm-hmm. I think in any company, when you have whatever company it is, when you have employees that are considered more than employees, and then mm-hmm. they've been with you for as long as they've been with Bruce, you know, I don't know. I mean, I just look at that. I'm like, somebody's doing something right.
Exactly.
If people are sticking around 30 plus years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yep. I think his longest tenured employee just made 30 years with Bruce, and is still, you know, a vital, important part. And has no plan on moving on, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that says a lot about the organization for people to be committed for that long. Well, Nick, I'm curious to know, if I were to drive down to the Chicago area in the next few days, are you playing any gigs in the Chicago area the next few weeks?
This week I'm going to Boston to go see my daughter.
Oh, okay. Well, I need to go to Boston then, right?
Parents weekend at Emerson College. So I'll give them a shout out. So I'll be going there. My daughter's studying media arts production at Emerson. So we're going there this weekend. And then the following week, God, you know, this is the life of a musician, short-term memory. So I could probably just
Pull out your calendar.
Yeah, pull out my calendar. I thought I had committed it to memory before I was going to do this interview. I was like, oh wait, I should probably remember this stuff. Actually the weekend after we'll be at Fitzgerald's on the 22nd.
Oh, okay.
And I do a little a weekly gig residency at a place on Taylor Street called the Taylor Street Tap. That's more or less like kind of a pro jam with me and friends that just show up, and we mm-hmm. just play the old school stuff all night long and just have a good time.
Oh, well, cool. Yeah. Well, I'll have to miss the gig on the 22nd. I've got one of my own that night, but I have to get down and keep track, come hear you live, because I sure love your recordings. Well, now that you've got another another CD, sure, date ourselves, don't we?
We actually will have it on album.
You are going to put it on vinyl.
I was just informed that so Alligator Records has started printing LPs again. Okay. because of the LP boom, the more people are buying LPs.
Right.
So that was one of the concerns about the length of my recording, was it had to be a certain length due to the vinyl. So
I just
asking for vinyl, it's coming.
Well, I just chuckle because I think, you know, that really dates us when we talk about albums and cassettes and I you know, when you were talking about Alligator Records, I remember back when I used to get their paper newsletter in the mail.
What's old is new again.
What's that?
What's old is new again.
Oh, exactly. But I used to get the paper newsletter in the mail, and then I'd order cassettes, you know, because you didn't have CD players yet. But anyway, now that you've got a new recording in the can.
Yes.
Are you still writing any new music?
I'm always writing music.
Okay.
So I always like jot down ideas on my little phone.
Sure,
I got this great thing. It's got the little notes section, so I can always keep notes. It's full of ideas and stuff.
Well, like David Letterman used to say, there is no off switch on genius. So
I don't know. Maybe David Letterman is a genius, but
yeah. Well, he used to say anyway. But I kind of figured that, you know, you were probably always one of those people who's always, there's always something swirling around and writing. Not everybody works that way, but I think a lot of people that I've interviewed over the past couple of years do. But I'm curious then, what typically then will inspire you to write something? What makes a song come to your head?
many, I am a great observer. It's one of my favorite things is, my dad used to just call it lazy.
Okay.
But it turned into a career for me because, like, I don't know. I really love people watching. I can sit in a crowded place and just watch people. I don't listen to a lot of radio or music, but I listen to shows. I listen to the news. One of my favorite things is riding around the country when we were on tour a lot and reading the marquees on church signs. And the Baptist churches in the South have the best sayings on their marquees. In fact, The High Cost of Low Living, my CD, came right off a Baptist church sign.
Oh, all right.
Okay. So that, you know, that was like I can't remember. We were like in West Virginia or something. This church said, you know, there's a high cost for low living. Clear your debt on Sunday or something like that.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's genius. So, you know, I'm constantly, you know, listening to people's conversations. You know, when we're talking, and if I hear a phrase or I hear something, you know, I just wrote a song on the new CD called "The Bait and the Snare."
Okay,
and that was something that was said, you know, by usually an older generation, and I'd heard people, you know, of my grandparents' generation, you know, say, you know, don't struggle with the bait and you won't get caught in the snare.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and yeah, it's just like little things like that. There was another song that I wrote years ago that was another phrase that I'd heard people say, that I'd rather be judged by 12 than carried by 6.
Ah,
you know, and like little things like that. I hear it and all of a sudden I think of a story behind that line. Like there's a story. I'm sure there's millions of stories behind that line, but I come up with my own story. I will take away some of the mystique and let people know, to make some of the procrastinators out there feel a little bit better about themselves, that I am a world-class procrastinator. And although I come up with many ideas, it's usually the week before I'm about to record when I go, okay, I got all these ideas. Oh man, I better start writing.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if it's just because I feel like I work better under pressure. Like I have, like now I have to get it done. I rarely have a song written completely before it's time to go in the studio. I'm not saying that I haven't. I have had like moments of inspiration, you know, months and months before, and I'm like, oh, I'm writing this thing. But mostly it's just ideas, melodies, little things, and then I panic about the week before the recording, and then I'm like, uh-oh, I better write them. So that's pretty much what happens on every one of my recordings, and this one was no different.
Nick, you're not alone. It's amazing how many singer-songwriters and composers I've talked to, and I say, what inspires you to write? And their response is, a deadline. There is something about that pressure to finally get it done. But, you know, I'll also speak on behalf of procrastinators everywhere. The advantage of being a procrastinator is you've always got something to do tomorrow and you've got today free.
That's right. I like that. I like that attitude.
Yeah. So there you go. Well, when inspiration does come to you, do you find that it, what hits first? Is it a melodic idea or a rhythm or maybe a vamp or some kind of mood? Is it a phrase that then your creative thinking assigns maybe a melodic shape to it, or?
More than likely, it's a phrase.
Okay.
That becomes a verse, that becomes a song.
Okay.
And then what I do is I try to fit the groove around the song. What kind of groove is going to rhythmically go along with how I can sing this? And a lot of times it changes, you know, there's different iterations of the song before I finally settle on the right groove for a song. Very rarely do I come up with a groove. Melody is a different thing unless it's an instrumental melody, just because in the blues you're kind of limited for melodies. You know, you got 12 bar, 8 bar, 16 bar blues, but 32 bar, I guess. But you're kind of limited there. So it's mostly a lot of grooves and rhythms. And sometimes, I would say 20% of the time, like I'll just be messing with a groove and like, I had to write a song over this. But the other 80% is I've already got ideas. And then I write the song, and then I try out different rhythms, different grooves, different slow, fast, medium. And I'm like, that doesn't work with this. Here we go. This works. And then it's fine tuning it and then refining. Even though, like I said, like I'll write that song a week or two before the session, every day I'm fine tuning and refining it. And even in the studio, like sometimes like we get into the studio and then we find that, we got to just fine tune it here and there. And then it hits. Yeah.
Well, I also suspect that, you correct me if I'm wrong, but based on the way you talk about your sidemen, that when you're in the studio, you're always open to ideas they might have as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I have in my head, I'll hear something of a generalization of like how I feel like I hear it in my head, how I think it should go. But I very rarely tell them, okay, you play like this, you play like this. I want you to play this. I want you to play this. I said, well, here's it. What I generally do is I will find, a song that's similar to it, you know, from the past, or like, okay, this is what I'm hearing. I'm hearing something like this, and I'll play that recording. I'm hearing something like this for this song here. Can we come close to something like this? And my guys are, you know, sure, they'll give it a listen. Okay. And then we play it, and 9 out of 10 times it's like, that's it. And occasionally it's like, you know what, now that I hear it back with us playing it rather than the recording that I played as, you know, as an example, maybe we should try something a little different. Maybe we should do, maybe the drummer should play, you know, a different, you know, backbeat, or get off the ride and go back on the snare a little bit more and hats more. And maybe the bass it doesn't need to be as busy or as sparse, maybe be a little bit more busy. You know, because again, like you said earlier, you know, like I'm not Muddy Waters. And if I write a song that's in the vein of a Muddy Waters song, I'm still not Muddy Waters. I'm Nick Moss doing a song that's similar to a Muddy Waters groove. And I can only do it the way I can. And if I do it the way I do it, I need to vary how I approach it too. I can go as close as I can, but it has to fit my approach.
It's got to have your fingerprints on it,
right? And the same thing with the guys in the band. Like I want them to have their fingerprints on it too.
Sounds like you work in a real great environment with a lot of high trust for your side guys. That's fantastic. Well, Nick, I only have a couple three more questions and then we'll wrap things up here, but one I'm going to ask you, everybody always says is the hardest question I ask. What is the most memorable gig that you have had?
That is a good one. There's so many. I will say the most memorable gig, the first one that stands out for me was, I was like 20, I can't even remember what year it was. 69, I might have been 24 or 25.
Okay.
I think it was 90. No, I was younger than that. Anyways, it was Jimmy Rogers' birthday, and it was the Chicago Blues Festival, and we played the main stage at the Chicago Blues Festival. Mm-hmm. And I was not supposed to play. I had only been in his band for about 3-4 months at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't supposed to play on the Blues Fest gig.
Mm-hmm.
And when we got back to Chicago after that tour, the Blues Fest gig was like 2 weeks away. And Jimmy called me and said, I want you to play on the gig with me. And so I was like, you know, super excited. Of course, I've never played on the Blues Fest at all. And I just remember standing on the stage that night, and Pine Top Perkins was there, and I think Cotton was there, and, you know, it was the whole band. Jimmy's son was there. Some guys that had played with Jimmy over the years were there. And Mick Jagger had recorded a birthday greeting that they played over the PA speaker for Jimmy for his birthday. And they turned the lights on up on the crowd. And I just remember seeing this sea of people from the front of the stage all the way back almost to Lake Michigan.
Wow.
And I'd never seen that many people before from perspective of a stage in my life. And I just remember, like, I don't know. It was just, to me, that's one of the most memorable gigs. And being there on that day to honor a guy like Jimmy Rogers on his birthday, being asked to be part of that, and then being able to experience that as a young musician, that was like, yeah, that was one of the probably most memorable things that's ever happened.
That's a great story. And especially when at the outset, you weren't expecting to even be there.
No, you know, I had only been in the band for a while. And
yeah,
when I got the call and I'm standing on stage next to these guys, and, you know, and Bob Margolin was there too for that. And I just remember walking on stage and plugging it. And I plugged into my amp, and it literally had just met him on stage, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Bob goes, "Who are you?" And I was like, "I'm Nick. My name is Nick Moss. I'm Jimmy's guitar player." He goes, "Oh, nice to meet you." And then we played the first couple of songs, and Bob kind of looked over at me and went, gave me a nod. And and I was like, "Oh, this is cool." And then they stopped the show, and the mayor wheeled out, came out, and the parks guy came out, and they wheeled out a big birthday cake for Jimmy. Oh. And they played that birthday greeting that Mick Jagger had done, you know, and the whole crowd erupted when they heard Mick Jagger's voice.
Of course.
You know, but it was just, yeah, that was probably one of the most memorable gigs I've ever
done. That's a great story. That's a great story. Well, I've got another question that's kind of related, but different. Now, Nick, if you could perform with any artist you have never performed with, either living or dead, who would that artist be and why?
Freddie King.
Okay.
Because arguably probably one of my biggest guitar and musical influences. You know, there's a lot of his playing in my playing.
Mm-hmm.
What a lot of people don't realize, I know, like, people probably remember him from those great 70s recordings that he did on Shelter and stuff, and they probably remember him from, like, his you know, instrumental hit stuff. But one of the things, you know, Freddie lived in Chicago as a young man, you know, as a teenager, and two of his idols were Eddie Taylor and Jimmy Rogers. And both of those guys were actually guitar teachers for him.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't realize that Jimmy or Freddie, in many interviews, gave that Jimmy Rogers was one of his favorite guys ever.
Wow.
So we have that in common. And the fact that he took his teachings from guys like Jimmy and Eddie Taylor and came up with that style that was all his own. But if you listen closely, you can hear both Jimmy and Eddie in his playing. And although I've probably remained a bit more traditional than Freddie was, I did veer off for a while and do some, you know, more rock or heavier stuff, mm-hmm. where you could even hear my more Freddie King influenced guitar playing. Mm-hmm. But the one thing that I always took away from Freddie King recordings, and then when I got to actually see video of Freddie King for the first time, his stage presence, his command of the stage, his power, just like so powerful of a man and as a musician and an entertainer. It gives me chills every time I think about it. And every time I can watch those videos of Freddie King playing like live at the Sugar Bowl. There's the videos of him playing on that show, The Beat. There's videos of him playing some like local shows in LA, mm-hmm. you know, and over the years I've collected all those recordings, and I can still to this day, put them on and still get the same feeling. It's just like, the sheer power. And I was very fortunate when I was playing with Jimmy Rogers for a while, that there was a period of time that we had Dave Maxwell on piano with us. Mm-hmm. And Dave Maxwell was Freddie King's longtime piano player. And the stories that Dave would tell about Freddie was just like, you know, I could sit there and listen to those stories all night long too. And yeah, I think being able to maybe just share the stage with Freddie King one time, you know, even if it was in my dreams or whatever, I think that would be a huge,
That's great to hear. That's a great story. Well, Nick, I just want to sum up with asking you if there's anything else that you would like to add or tell my audience that I haven't asked you about.
No, you're pretty good. You did. You got some great questions, and you know, I don't know if you've done this research for a long time, or if this is just something that you've always known, but you're very well versed and well knowledged in this stuff. And I don't know. I would just like to retouch on what we had talked about earlier. I hope that maybe through what we talked about today, and maybe whatever interviews you've done in the past with other like-minded musicians would make some people want to go back and listen to the music and the old school music. And mm-hmm. I'm not saying that, you know, not to throw away all your rock blues records or throw away all your modern records, but I really feel an importance with, as you know, as a musician, as a blues musician, as someone here in America, the importance that we talk about every day, that you see on the news, the importance of people saying about, you know, how important America is, and we've got to keep America this and that, and yet we've excluded, you know, I don't want to go on a real political rant, but there's an exclusion of a race of people who mm-hmm. they don't feel is important. And the reason why rock music and rock blues even became popular was because the record companies and radio stations, they don't want to promote people of color. They want to promote white people. And I understand that music sells. And I understand they got to sell more records, and there was probably more of a white audience to sell those records to. But that doesn't mean that nowadays, now that we're going back and we're learning stuff, that we should lose the history of the people that gave us this music, the people that created this music, that gave us this wonderful gift of music, and any art form that was created by someone else. Man, you have to give it its reverence and its respect. And don't let it go by the wayside. I don't care if it moves on. I don't care if you want to let it grow. That's wonderful. Everything needs to grow and everything needs to move on. But I don't want it to ever be forgotten. That's all.
No, I you're preaching to the choir, man. I agree with you 100%. I mean, that's, you know, it's like I have, you know, since I've retired, I have 6 different jazz groups because I have different tastes in jazz. So I have got a modern jazz group. We focus on, you know, everything from bebop forward, you know, 1940s forward, but I also have an early jazz group. It's nothing but pre-1930. And I feel the same way about the blues and you know, the blues is the taproot of all American music. And it's something that we really should, we should have and did. So much higher. Go ahead. Right.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
So as someone that is deeply rooted in jazz as you are, don't you kind of find it ironic that this is one of the things that, like, when I talk to some of my friends about jazz and I get varying degrees of answers, and I don't judge any of these answers, but I'm always curious. I'm like, don't you find it ironic that blues music, that most of the great jazz artists of our time started as blues musicians and had their love of blues music, and it gets so little respect?
Exactly. Because, you know, I mean, you think about it, you know, the earliest jazz musicians were inflecting blues sounds into what were otherwise straight, you know, marches and band pieces that a lot of brass bands and so on were playing. And somebody finally said, hey, that's kind of cool. Let's figure out how to fill some of this space.
Right.
You know, in a tune. And so improvisation, you know, kind of starts to fill that. But what I found really, an eye opener for me was, there's a series of educational videos that's done by the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra. And also, Preservation Hall in New Orleans has a wonderful series of videos, which I share because I have younger musicians that play with me, and I need to make sure to get them up to speed on these earlier styles. And so there's one video that basically talks about old New Orleans clarinet playing.
Right.
And the guy that's doing the video, the couple of guys, clarinet player, piano player, very well versed in the history and could demonstrate, you know, how a clarinetist would create a line to go against a melodic line, and then how he would inflect it with, well, what we're called blue notes, you know, the flatted thirds and fifths and sevenths, you know, those kind of things, and how those elements really added interesting color. You know, like, I forget who it is that there's a modern day jazz arranger. He says the difference between jazz and the blues and pop music is pop music only uses the white notes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Harmonically. Very, very basic, very in some ways very bland, because a lot of pop music gets its whiz bang from electronic effects and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
You know, we like to use all 12 notes of the keyboard when we play the blues, when we play jazz, you know, because we like a lot of spice, we like a lot of color, a lot of oomph in our music. And I think that's why it appeals to those of us who love the blues and who love jazz, is because there's a certain spice in that music that
called emotion.
Well, emotion, yeah. I mean, that's what I would say spice is to me. The spice is that feeling that you get in your gut that you can't describe, but you know it's there.
Right.
And you get it when you hear, you know, that the music. You know, and you've talked today numerous times about your response to hearing the music. And I can't say that I know exactly what you feel, because we all respond to music differently. But I do know that there's a certain something that I feel deep in my guts when I listen to the blues or when I listen to jazz that maybe I don't get when I'm listening to, you know, the latest pop tune.
Right. I remember Jimmy Rogers told me one night, and we're sitting alone after a show. One of my favorite things to do would be to sit with the old man and just let him talk. He'd have his whiskey, and we're sitting by ourselves. We were overseas somewhere, and place had already closed, and we kind of had access to this bar, and we're just sitting there by ourselves late at night, and he was telling me all these great stories. And as he was telling the stories, he was reminiscing. And as he was reminiscing, you could tell he was getting emotional about his friends that weren't around anymore. And then he was saying, what drives me to keep playing at my age is my nostalgia and my love and the emotion that we all through these years put in to making this music. And I remember him saying, if you've never cried when you played the blues, then you've never played the blues.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember how hard that hit me, because like to that point, I had never cried while I was playing. Like I didn't quite understand that. And I felt like a fraud, you know. Mm-hmm. Here I am, a white guy playing blues in the first place. So I'm already kind of walking a line there. Until like I started having experiences of my own in my life. And then when, you know, an experience that happened to me at one point where I didn't even think I could go on stage. And then I had to play while I was on stage while tears were just streaming down my face. And I understood it at that point, at that exact moment, mm-hmm. what Jimmy had told me years earlier. And like, and it became even more real to me and connected me even further to that music.
Sure.
And like I've heard some other people say without emotion in music it's just mathematics.
Exactly. No, I'm with you 100%. I mean, the thing, Nick, that I always find challenging is trying to talk to somebody who's a non-musical person. Okay. In other words, they're not a musician or not musically trained. You know, the only thing they play is the radio, and right. try to explain to them why I continue at my age, continue to play, continue to, you know, go out and find newer musicians to come play with me and all that, why I'm driven. And I said, I can't explain it to you. I just know I feel I have to. And maybe yeah. it's because, you know, music is a drug that once you become addicted to it, you just can't kick it.
Exactly. It's, you know, exactly. Like when I was telling you about, like when I was a kid and I listened to that B.B. King record for the first time, and all I know is I felt something before I heard it. That was my first hit. And I've been chasing that hit ever since. I've been chasing that, you know, ever since. And, you know, people, like you were saying, like people that don't play. And I've had people say, well, why, how can you do that? Like every, like, why do you, what makes you do it? And I said, you know, try to explain to them the emotion feeling. And sometimes they don't understand that. But the easiest thing I do is not the easiest, but one of the examples that I give is, have you ever not turned on a song that was special to you because you were feeling a certain way?
Yeah.
Someone passed away, or you had broken up with a loved one and you turned on a song and it just like that whole song just spoke to you. Well, yeah. I'm like, well, that's what it's like every night for me.
Yep. And the high that you get from playing is, I don't know how it is for you, but I know yeah. for me, when I have a great gig, I can't get to sleep. I get home and I'll lay awake 4 or 5 hours. I mean, you know, I had a really just fantastic gig about 3 weeks ago at a club in Lake Mills, Wisconsin with my 8-piece. And it was such a high. I got home and it was probably 4 or 5 a.m. before I got to sleep.
Yeah, that's a regular occurrence. Because
you're just laying awake going, wow, it was such an incredible experience. So it's fantastic. Hey, well, Nick, I had to let you go. We've been on for almost an hour and a half. Can you believe that?
Wow.
Time flies and you're having fun. But Nick, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today. And I am wishing you all the best for what I'm sure is going to be a continued successful musical future. And we'll be looking for that new album in 2023.
Absolutely, man. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate you thinking about me and inviting me on your show. And I wish you all great success too in your show and in your music too.
Thanks, Nick.
My discovery composer of the week is Michael McGlynn. Born in 1964 in Dublin, Ireland, Michael's music combines elements of modality and contemporary compositional practices. He founded the choral ensemble Anuna in 1987, and in 2018 he founded Manam. Michael specializes in the composition of music for voices, and his extensive output includes a number of pieces that have entered the standard repertoire of choirs and vocal ensembles all over the world. His setting of Irish language texts in particular fuses modality, alternating time signatures and medieval tone colors in a unique fashion that is instantly recognizable as his work. The best known of these include Duliman and Gentry from 1995, Incantations from 1989, Himbara from 1994, and Era Nangrena from 1990. His music spans a huge range of textures, encompassing larger scale occasional pieces such as Agnus Dei, 2005, commissioned by Chanticleer, and Ma'alalu, 2021, commissioned by Tampere Vocal Festival. In 2017, Michael was the recipient of the University College Dublin Alumni Award in Arts and Humanities and was visiting eminent scholar at the Music Department of Florida Atlantic University from 2011 to 2013. In 2019, he became part of the UCD Creative Fellows. He was artistic director of the Tampere Vocal Festival in 2021. Michael has produced and recorded 17 albums for Anuna. Anuna, 1993, Celtic Origins, 2007, and Christmas Memories, 2008, have featured in the United States Billboard charts. Deep Dead Blue, 1999, was nominated for a Classical Brit Award and went top 5 in the UK classical charts. In February 2017, Michael co-directed with Japanese national treasure Gensho Umiwaka a collaborative No Theater Anuna performance entitled Takahima at Orchard Hall, Tokyo. This was an adaptation of the W.B. Yeats No-inspired play At the Hawk's Well. A semi-improvised score was commissioned for the production. Michael's music has been commissioned, recorded, and performed by ensembles that include the BBC Singers, Rajaton, Voces 8, Apollo 5, the National Youth Choir of Great Britain, Grammy-winning United States ensembles Conspirare and the Phoenix Chorale. These include Amran Nagyoth for Chanticleer and Opia Virgo for New York Polyphony, which appears on their Grammy-nominated CD, Sing Thee, Noel. In 2019, Kansas City Chorale released an entire CD dedicated to Michael's compositions entitled Artifacts, The Music of Michael McGlynn. He has written songs in many genres, collaborating with The Wiggles, Elvis Costello, and with country music legend Rodney Crowell, whose acclaimed 2017 album, Close Ties, includes a song written with Michael and features Crowell duetting with Sheryl Crow. He worked as composer and musical director for the Gate Theater Royal Court presentation of Chekhov's Three Sisters, which featured the legendary Cusack family and was directed by Adrian Noble. As a tenor soloist, Michael specializes in early music repertoire, and in that capacity shared a stage with the legendary Jeff Buckley at Elvis Costello's Meltdown Curatorship in London. He is also featured on a number one single in Ireland, duetting with Jerry Fish on the track True Friends. McGlynn has also created shorts and promotional films for Manam, Anuna, Wexford Opera Festival, and his short films Shadows of the Lowlands and Dreams of the Past, Memories of My Soul, used to promote the release of the video games Xenoblade 2, Nintendo 2018, and Chrono Cross, The Radical Dreamers Edition, Square Enix 2022. McGlynn lives in Dublin with his family and is a year-round sea swimmer and occasional surfer. The All Music Guide lists two recordings of McGlynn's chamber music, 27 recordings of his choral works, 24 of his works for voice with accompaniment, and 5 miscellaneous works. In my show notes is a link to a YouTube performance of Acuna performing McGlynn's Duliman. That wraps episode number 112. My show notes, along with links to artist websites, recording label websites, YouTube videos of artist performances, are all posted on my Facebook page, The Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. Coming up next week will be my interview with East Coast jazz drummer Zach Edelman. Other upcoming interviews include Nashville-based Americana roots rock singer-songwriter Scott Clay, New York City-based jazz trombonist and band leader Alton Sinclair, and San Francisco Bay Area-based jazz pianist and composer Myra Melford. So don't touch that dial and stay tuned. If you have questions, comments, or a suggestion of an artist, composer, or musical style for me to consider, you may email me at hurstc@uwm.edu. So until next time, this is Professor Craig W. Hurst and Carmel the Wonder Dog signing off from The Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. Have a great day.